This is the forgetting.
Alzheimer's is like a light going off. And I've asked people in my book on Pluto, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's, I try to simplify it by saying, okay, how many people in the room have lived in a home with a basement? Everyone's hand shut up. You know, how many people do the laundry down there? Hand shoots up. I said, how many people have been in the basement at night doing the laundry when someone up at the kitchen doesn't realize you're down there and flicks the light off? And everyone says, oh, yeah. And I said, yeah, you say, oh, shit. And you drop an expletive. And you yell and you scream. And that's early onset Alzheimer's. The light goes off in your brain. You don't know when it's going to happen. And you yell and scream. And you might yell, fuck, and God damn it. And it's the rage of Alzheimer's. And sometimes that can trigger the brain going back on again. But then it goes off again. It goes on. It goes off. It goes on. And then you know down deep inside that at some point there isn't going to be anyone up in the kitchen. The light's going to go off forever and no one's going to turn it back on. I started going into rage and they've seen it and they tried to calm me down and I couldn't find it. And the more I couldn't find it, the more rage I went into. And then I start kicking things. And this isn't me, David. I'm a calm guy. And this is the disease, the f***ing demon. And I went into the house and I slammed the door. And Mary Catherine will tell you this is exactly what went down. And she's out there crying. And it's just hard to talk about, but This disease sucks, David.
Hi, Greg.
How you doing, David? How's it going? It's always a pleasure to hear from you, my friend.
That's very nice of you to say.
You're still smarter than me, but I'm better looking, and I just wanted to say that on the air so everyone understands that.
I think you've got it reversed there.
Really? Well, I forget a lot, so, you know. Maybe we should just put it up on the website and let people decide.
I think that's an excellent idea. We could have a vote.
Okay, I'll give people a hint. I'm the guy with the hair.
I'll be the final tallier of the votes, oh,
okay.
If you don't mind.
Yeah, no, that's fine. And then you'll just tell me, and I won't remember, so that's okay.
Yeah, but I'll be very fair. You can trust me in most matters.
Are you going to tell me, like all my buddies now, that I still owe you $100?
Is that now a common trick that your friends try to play on you?
Oh, yeah. One of my good buddies, Jimmy Diani, who I grew up with in Rye, New York, when he heard about my diagnosis, he's like a brother, and he called me, and we talked for 45 minutes, and it was a real sincere talk. And he's an Irish guy with a sense of humor, and at the end of the conversation, he said, hey, Greg, by the way, do you remember you owe me $100? So I started laughing, and then it caught on, and now everyone in the country says, when I know them, hey, Greg, you owe me $100. Do you remember? And then I have a couple friends who are a little more well-heeled, and they say, Greg, you don't owe me $100. You owe me $1,000. So I guess I owe people a lot of money.
You know, one of the funny things about what you just said is that you called your friend like a brother to you. And, you know, you and I haven't known each other for that long. It's only been a couple of years. But I don't think it was too long before I felt like I was a brother to you. And I think a lot of people who know you feel that way. You have a way of connecting with people that is just so powerful, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to try to do this podcast, because I've seen you in front of audiences, I've seen you one-on-one with individuals, I felt the power of your humanity one-on-one with me, and you know, I've been trying to raise awareness about Alzheimer's disease for almost 20 years now, and you came along. And boom, you did much, much more than I have ever done in just a matter of months.
Well, you know, I always say a limited range, but comfortable, you know, in my range. And I've always, you know, my nickname on Cape Cod is the Senator from Cape Cod. I've always been, you know, Irish, gregarious. And now in Alzheimer's, you're fighting the fear of being alone. And so I reach out to the heart of others when I feel their hearts are reaching out to me. There was a time, David, when, and like you, you know, with, through my parents, through God, the universe, however you want to define it, I was blessed with a good IQ intellect. And my brain used to be my best friend, and I don't see any chance for reconciliation now. So I've learned to write and speak from the heart, the place of the heart. I believe that the heart is the place of the soul, and it's what survives when we leave. And I'm not trying to define religion or belief for anyone. We all have to find that. But, you know, as the great Bugs Bunny once said, don't take life too seriously because nobody gets out alive. But what survives, I believe, is your heart, your soul. And I've been on the search for that. And when I connect with people like you and others, you know, in that process, I connect in the heart. And then they become brothers and sisters. And so I'm sincere when I say you're a brother because we've connected in that place of the heart. We remember what we want to remember, but the heart is unfiltered. And in Alzheimer's, you become unfiltered and you reach out to others who are open to that. And so, you know, maybe that's, I don't know if blessing is the right word, but maybe that's an upside of Alzheimer's.
Well, thankfully for all of us, you're still awfully good with words and you're still obviously very, very good at connecting those words to your heart. So,
but,
let's
you know,
talk
one thing, David, just to get back, just for people to, you know, it's like, don't try this trick at home. When I talk to you right now, I'm interested in reaching souls, hearts. But this isn't easy, and I have to struggle through it. But you know, and so what I'm telling people is, you know, lying down in wrestling is a position of defeat. So don't lie down, sit up, stand up to the extent that you can.
Well, all right. So if you're at your, you know, pretty much your best right now, because you sound very on and with it, and you're really connecting in
seventh cup of coffee, David.
And maybe I need a few cups of coffee because I want to get I want to try to be as articulate as you're being. But let's talk about some of your worst moments. I mean, was there? You want to start with this morning and kind of what you felt like when you woke up or what. Tell me what it feels like when you are in that basement and the light goes off. What's an example of that?
Well, I've said before, I'm old school, and I think of my brain as an old file cabinet where everything is ordered the way it should be. And it's like someone at night came in and ransacked my files and spread them the hell all over the floor. And then when I wake up in the morning, before, you know, I go to the bathroom, I have to lie in bed and put the files back, the who, where, what, when, why, and how of who I am. And so I have a sense, and it's always a moment every morning, David, of high anxiety. And then I get up and go to the bathroom, and you know, there are times that, you know, I brush my teeth with hand soap, or I've gargled with rubbing alcohol, and it doesn't have a thin, minty taste. And so I've learned to label, you know, things in the bathroom. And then I go about my day. And it's a day, I can't get through the day without strategies. And you know, I have to have lists for everything. And everything I write down on my laptop or everything I write down on my iPhone, I'll send myself 50 emails a day. Because right now, David, 60% of my short-term memory can be gone in 30 seconds. Just like, boom, boom. And it sucks, David. It sucks, and the rage is out of control. I'm now losing my sense of smell, taste, balance. You know, in Ireland, I just got back with the family. I go over there every year, and for the first time in 10 years, I could not remember what I did the day before. It was gone, nothing, and I started writing that down. There are times now where I'm losing my phone and my laptop 20 times a day. I'm putting my keys in my my iPhone in the damn refrigerator or the microwave. The other day, my wife pulled out a business card from the dishwasher. I had put a business card in the dishwasher because it had a coffee stain on it, and I thought that that was how it was going to clean up. And the disease is it continues to come for me, and this was last week, probably 15 times I lost my phone, and it was at night, and I couldn't find my phone again. And it's not a matter of losing something. It's because the phone has become an extension of me. The laptop has become, so it's like I'm losing my freaking brain. God damn it, where is it? And so I start yelling and screaming, and my son Connor was home and my wife, and I started going into rage, and they've seen it, and they tried to calm me down, and I couldn't find it, and the more I couldn't find it, the more rage I went into. And then I start kicking things, and this isn't me, David. I'm a calm guy, and this is the disease, the f***ing demon. And so then I said, okay, maybe it's in the car, and I start yelling at my wife and Connor to call my phone, and I go out to my Jeep, and you know, I can hear the phone ringing, but because, like with my smell and my taste and balance, my hearing is all screwed up now. I can't tell where sounds are coming from. So now I know the damn phone is in the car, and I can't find it. So I'm even greater rage. So finally, I get my phone, and you think I would be happy. What I did in the moment is, as I grabbed one of my favorite coffee cups, which later my wife told me was her favorite coffee cup. I was so angry. I was a distance from pitcher's mound to home plate from this rock wall at the house. I fired a perfect strike with this coffee cup, left-handed, and I'm right-handed, to smash it against this rock. And I yelled out as loud as I could in the neighborhood, and I hope this is okay to say, God damn this f***ing disease. If you want me, God damn it, come take me now. And I started crying. And I went into the house, and I slammed the door. And Mary Catherine will tell you this is exactly what went down. And she's out there crying. And it's just hard to talk about, but this disease sucks, David. So I realized after I slammed the door, the light went on. I said, holy shit. And I went back out, and she's sobbing. And she put her arms around me, and she said, Greg, I know this is not you. It's the disease. And I've been telling my wife recently that because a lot of things are breaking down, and it's the first time I'm starting to say it, I can't wait to get out of this body. And I told Mary Catherine last Wednesday, maybe I should start to give in. Mm. And what my doctors have told me, and Alzheimer's affects people differently, what is keeping me in the game at the level, and I have moments, like right now I can talk, but I'll have other moments when I'm out on Pluto, I'm in a daze, I'm in a rage, I'm seeing things that aren't happening, I'm forgetting. And I'm getting to this stage where I'm saying, okay, maybe I'll give in. No sooner did I say that, the Irish took over in me, and I said, f*** that, I'm not giving in. You can f***ing come get me, Alzheimer's, but I'm not. You're not going to get my speech and my writing until you take it with your cold hands.
You know, as you're telling the story about the rage, I'm also wondering if you're getting upset almost as a device to rev up your brain. You know, because you're getting so excited, and maybe you're kind of that's a way to get yourself, you know, clicked back into.
I think that's true. I mean, in high school, all I ever did was cut up a frog. So I'm not a medical expert, but I, as a journalist, I've studied this. I think with rage, and the doctors are far able to talk about it better than me, I think it's a combination of synapse not happening in your brain. It's a combination in the early stages of knowing that something bad just happened and it shouldn't have happened. And also it may be a device, as you just said, to get into that Rocky mode where you're going to fight. You're going to get up and you're going to fight.
I think I should read the intro now, and we'll find a way to put it back in earlier. From WCAI in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and Argo Studios in New York City, this is The Forgetting, a new podcast about dementia. I'm David Shank, author of the book The Forgetting, and senior advisor to an international research consortium called Cure Alzheimer's Fund, which helps make this podcast possible. And with me is my very dear friend and permanent co-host, Greg O'Brien. Greg is author of, I'm going to call it the second best book about Alzheimer's disease, a truly great memoir called On Pluto. I thought I would get a little chuckle there, Greg. But
I think speaking of The Forgetting, I think you're forgetting that On Pluto, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's is maybe the best book, and readers should read both and discern. So that's all I could say.
Well, again,
that's all I got.
So what you're doing in the book and what you're doing in your talks is really what inspired me to try to start this podcast, and we'll see where it goes. But the idea is very simple, and that is that you are putting yourself out there. You're totally, brutally honest about this disease, about your experience with it, your firsthand experience with it, and you've committed the rest of your life to documenting what's going on with you in public as a way of raising awareness of the disease and of fighting it and hopefully assisting the cure for the disease. So my small idea was, well, let's try to document that on the air. You know, we have there's lots of well-known examples now of people who are renowned in broadcasting who actually get dementia and then leave broadcasting for very understandable reasons because they're not as articulate anymore, and they don't want to broadcast their decline. They want to leave before they do seriously decline. They don't want people to hear that. But what we're going to do is really exactly the opposite of that. We're putting you on the air now, and we're going to try to talk often and for as long as we possibly can. And we're going to, among other things, we're going to document what this disease is doing to you, and we're going to honor your struggle against it and your passion for raising awareness to hopefully finally stop it.
Well, I think, David, a journalist needs to tell the story, and there's a lot in my life that I've lost, my sense of identity, my self-esteem, but what I'm fighting against the demons of this disease as long as I can is to hold on to my writing and my speech. It is who I am, and maybe that's the way I'm able to do it. And at the end of the day, I'm a journalist, so shame on me if I don't tell the story, and shame on me after losing my maternal grandfather to Alzheimer's, my mother to Alzheimer's. I had a front row seat for both. 4 months ago, my paternal uncle died of Alzheimer's, and before my father died, he was diagnosed with dementia. And years ago, I began the symptoms, horrific short-term memory, not recognizing people I've known all my life, including my wife on two occasions, not recognizing familiar places, hallucinations. And I tried to live in the world of denial. One of the chapters of my book is Denial Ain't Just a River in Egypt. And it got to the point where the demon started overtaking me. And then I had a serious head injury, which doctors said unmasked a disease in the making. It's almost like what you read about in pro football and soccer, the head injuries that can accelerate a dementia. I don't believe a head injury will cause it, but if you're predisposed, and I've had two horrific traumatic head injuries, and then I had the brain scan, the SPECT scan, and the clinical test, which all confirmed the diagnosis, and I also carry Alzheimer's marker gene APOE4, which appears to be on both sides of the family. So, you know, at that point, the doctor said, in a good way, you know, Greg, you're not getting out of it. What are you going to do? You ought to write about it. And so I said, okay. And you know, the first thing I did is I went into a pity party because I got the diagnosis of Alzheimer's 2 weeks after I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And then I had the WTF talk with God, and you could figure out what that means. And then I went back to my muscle memory and started copiously taking notes, 2,000 pages of notes of what I was afraid that I was going to forget, and chronicling what was going on with my mother and me. And from that, I wrote the book. And it was a several-year project. And, you know, I'm working on another book now called Beyond Pluto, Journey from the Mind to the Heart. And, you know, I feel that I have something to say. And yeah, you know, in this book, you got to strip yourself naked. I'm 65. I probably looked a lot better naked when I was 35. But what the hell? If that's what it takes to get the country's attention, that Alzheimer's is not the end stage only when you're 85 years old and you're going to die of something. It is a disease that can take 20 to 25 years to run its course with horrific symptoms of you know, it's the death in slow motion. Having a sliver of your brain shaved every day, and there are people, you know, and Still Alice, the fictional character Alice Hallin, was teaching at Harvard. I gave a speech in Cambridge recently, and two Harvard professors came up and said, "Your book is spot on, and we know because we both have early onset, and we're still teaching at Harvard." And until this country can start to realize that there are people who are fighting this disease every day, but not only, we don't want pity. I don't want anyone's freaking pity. I want them to understand that this disease is going to take out the baby boom generation. It's going to take out their children. And we need to stand together. We need to get the Congress to appropriate the funds so we can do the research and find the cure. This is not your grandfather's disease.
Sean, it would be great if you could get our guest today online, and then we'll move to that segment. Terrific.
Hi, hey, David.
Hi. Let me introduce you, Jed. Let me introduce you formally. Jed Levine is Executive Vice President and Director of Programs and Services of the New York City Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. And the reason, Jed, I invited you to be our very first guest on this new podcast is that you're the very first person that I met professionally working in the Alzheimer's community when I started to do research on this disease almost 20 years ago. And you were very, very gracious in giving a lot of time to someone who knew nothing about the disease and making introductions for me, letting me sit in on early stage support groups, and you were my go-to guy, and you helped open the door to this extraordinary, very sad, but very important world. So I thought it would be fitting for us to talk on this first podcast that we're trying. So thank you for doing this.
Oh well, thank you for asking me, and it's hard to believe it's almost 20 years.
You do such great work. I'm such a big fan of the Alzheimer's Association, but particularly your chapter, because the Alzheimer's is kind of broken up into, it's got a national organization, but they also have, I think it's hundreds of chapters, is it, scattered throughout the United States?
I think it's about 80 chapters now.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
What does the New York City chapter do as opposed to the national organization? Help define what it is that you do.
Well, I think, you know, all of the chapters, you know, we all share a common mission, and we're all, you know, we both support research and disseminate information about research, which is really important. But I think where the chapters live and breathe, and especially this chapter, is in the provision of care and support services for people with the disease and their families and the professionals who care for them. And also creating, you know, awareness about this disease, and especially in a city like New York, which is so diverse. We have a large Latino population. We have a large African-American population. We have a large and growing Asian population, particularly Chinese. And in those areas, we've done a lot of work on the ground, kind of helping people understand what this is. There are a lot of myths and a lot of just lack of knowledge about it. And also recognizing that, you know, as you know, there's no the medical treatment is very limited, and we're not where we want to be yet in terms of treatment or prevention or slowing down the disease. But what we have learned so much over the past, you know, many years that I've been doing this is that we understand so much more about the experience from the perspective of the person with the disease, and we know so much about what the caregiver is going through, and we know ways to help and support and provide some guidance and direction.
Jeb, Greg O'Brien, one of the things, particularly as a journalist, I think that we have to attack are the myths, because I think the myths distract from getting at the issue itself. And the biggest myth that I think is that people stereotype the disease that you're 80, 90 years old, you're in a nursing home, and you're incontinent. I'm 65, and I could be incontinent, and yet I have to get up every day and function. And maybe if it's helpful, David, you're kind of in charge here, but I am better looking, as I told you. if you could talk a little bit about the myths and how you think we push back on that, if you think that's relevant.
Well, Jed, why don't you say what you think the biggest myth is that you encounter?
Well, I think there are several. I think the one that Greg alluded to, which is that this is a disease that affects people who are in their 80s and 90s. And indeed, although it is primarily a disease of aging, there's a significant number of people who are under the age of 65 who are affected. So there is this early onset form of the disease, the young onset form, that's still hard. We hear from our clients here that they have a hard time getting diagnosed. You know, they go through often a year or more of incorrect diagnoses before they get to the right place and are accurately diagnosed as having dementia, either Alzheimer's or mixed dementia or whatever it might be. So I think that's clearly one of the big myths. I think the other big myth is that there's nothing you can do. We know so much more about caring for the person with the disease and caring for their caregiver and the importance of this ongoing support. I think so many people feel so alone and so helpless and hopeless when they hear that diagnosis. And the fact is that we know that people who get that kind of support and care get connected to the resources of the association and other organizations and get connected to the community resources, that they actually do better, and that there is a health economic benefit as well, that the cost for their care in the long run is significantly lowered in some studies.
Jed, that point about isolation and alone is so critical. I've been in the position of being a caregiver for my mother and now dealing with the disease. And the alone part, and that's why it's so important to get early diagnosis, because, my book is about on Pluto living with Alzheimer's, not dying with it. The death part comes later. And the Alzheimer's Association, the Cure Alzheimer's Fund, Us Against Alzheimer's, all of those groups are out there fighting, and you feel that you're not alone. And what happens is that no one wants to talk about this disease. The umbrella word is dementia. It's got a Latin word picture of a demon howling in the desert, and everyone is afraid to talk about it. I'm losing my brain. I'm losing myself. We've talked about it before. I got cancer, but the Alzheimer's scares me more. Mm-hmm. And everyone is afraid to discuss it. And we have to try to find a way of making Alzheimer's popular. And the other thing that I don't want to go on a sidetrack here, I'd like someday to see the name dementia changed.
And I think we are moving towards that. I know that words certainly have tremendous power, and the word dementia is a very negative, connotates all kinds of negative images. So I agree with you, and I think there's actually work being done now to do that in the medical field. So, and talk about cognitive, impairment and or other ways of phrasing it that are perhaps a little more descriptive rather than using the
negative word
dementia. Let me mention one other myth, which I think Greg began talking about, and that's the sense of loss of self. Even though, and we know how terrible Alzheimer's is, and the fact that people become more dependent and they need more assistance and they lose the ability to communicate in the same way. And even people who are quite advanced, if you know how to connect, if you know that there's a way of engaging people, you can connect with that essential self that is still there.
And we need to stop telling people, I'm sorry, you got a death sentence, because, you know, we're all going to die someday. No one's getting out alive. And,
right.
And we need to teach people to that you're not alone, and you can be productive. And in some cases, maybe you can be more productive. And we just need to lift the veil of failure. You know, that's the first thing I felt when I got the diagnosis. What a freaking loser. Mm. You know, I had this great life and now I've lost everything. And then good friends and doctors started kicking me in the ass and said, get up your ass and get up off your ass and fight. And I think that's what we need to do with encouragement from others like you.
But I also, you know, I know that everybody experiences this in their own way and has their own way of coping. But I think we, and I also don't want to dismiss or negate the experience of the family caregiver.
Mm. Jed, thank you so much for being with us today. It's a treat to have you on this first podcast, and it was great to hear you talk about how your work has evolved, and it was a treat to hear you interact with Greg, and hopefully we can do this again.
Well, my pleasure, and thank you so much for asking. I'm honored to be the first guest on this terrific program. So thank you both.
Thank you.
All right. Talk to you again. Thanks a lot, Jed.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Well, you really are a journalist, Greg. That wasn't just bluster. You know how to ask a question,
well,
don't you?
I got a limited range, buddy, but I'm going to die a journalist. So
you know how to
So
how
you
to
know
listen.
What? Get used to it. Well, you know, the Alzheimer's, there's pluses and minuses and more minuses and pluses, but Alzheimer's creates, at least it has in me, a sense of urgency. The train has left for me, David. You know, I'm realistic. I love to listen to all of the banging of the drums of potential cures and things like that, but the journalist in me says that we're a long way away from a cure, but maybe closer to protecting my children. But they won't forget. And the other thing it is with caregivers that I think is so hurtful, as it is with people with Alzheimer's and dementia, there's some people who want to connect, which is why I connected with you as a brother and I've connected with others. But there are others who just can't. I understand it. We're all human, so I'm not criticizing. They step back and it's like you have leprosy and they don't want to touch you.
Have you been surprised by some people that you would have expected to come in closer to you and be more supportive and really are kind of exhibiting that almost surreal fear and pulling away? And maybe there have also been people that you would have expected would have pulled away that have actually drawn closer.
Yeah, and I think it's their own internal fear and the unknown, which gets back to a point I made early on. We have to demystify this disease. We have to beat back the myths about it. You know, there was a great Chinese military tactician, if that's the right word, who once said that tactics without strategy is a noise before defeat. And, you know, we need to have strategies.
So as the podcast goes on in future episodes, we'll try to diffuse as many of those myths as possible. We'll try to help educate people about the stages. We'll try to help educate people in layman's terms about what's actually going on in the brain in the way that I started to a few minutes ago. And maybe that will help people break through the taboo and maybe draw closer together, draw closer to the person who's been diagnosed as opposed to pushing away.
I think that makes sense.
That's it for our show today. Greg and I want to thank our colleagues at Cure Alzheimer's Fund, especially Rudy Tanzi, chair of its International Research Consortium. In between his breakthrough discoveries in Alzheimer's, Rudy composed and performed our theme music. Yes, he is Superman. We also want to thank today's special guest, Jed Levine. Paul Ruest is my engineer here at Argo Studios in New York City on 26th Street. And at WCAI in Woods Hole, the engineer is Dan Tridle. Thank you, Dan. The Forgetting is a production of WCAI. Our producer is the great Sean Corcoran. Thank you so much for helping us put this together, Sean. And Greg, thank you for taking this leap with me and for everything you do. And let's keep talking.
Until we meet again, David.